Ladies and gentlemen, tonight it's my great privilege to introduce this evening's speaker, a man who's described by both his philosophical opponents and his collaborators as one of America's leading intellectuals. Today it's very difficult to have any discussion of any of the most controversial moral and cultural issues facing the United States and the world today without at some point and in some way encountering the name and thought of Professor Robert P. George. Among the many positions that he holds, Professor George is the McCormick Professor of Jurisprudence at Princeton. He's founder and director of the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions at Princeton. He's also a professor of politics at Princeton. He's a prolific writer with 16 written or edited books to his credit, and has published in many journals, including the Harvard Law Review, the Yale Law Journal, the Review of Metaphysics, and the American Journal of Jurisprudence. He's also a member of the President's Council on Bioethics. He's previously served as a presidential appointee to the United States Commission on Civil Rights and as a former judicial fellow at the United States Supreme Court. He holds a JD and a master's degree in theology from Harvard, as well as a DPhil in legal philosophy from Oxford University. Now, I could go on and on and on and on and elaborate on many of Professor George's achievements, but it would perhaps be more appropriate simply to note that Professor George's life and work is dominated by a synthesis that's as old as Christianity itself, and that's the synthesis of faith and reason. In this regard, perhaps Professor George's most significant work that will be judged in the long term will be the effort that he, along with a small band of fellow travelers, have made over the past 30 years to reinvigorate natural law theory and apply it rigorously to subjects in principled ways that challenge the present secularist landscape of Western thought. Among his greatest admirers are evangelical Christians, many of whom say Professor George has shown them, both through his words and his witness, how to pursue the cause of truth in our very, very secular public square. And by this I don't just mean the rigorous pursuit of rational arguments, but also character traits such as civility, gentleness, and humour. He has, it's been said, a way of speaking with southern graciousness and northern directness. Now, of course, speaking graciously is not Professor George's only southern characteristic. He originally hails from a state called West Virginia, which is famous for many things, including its very black coal, its very beautiful mountains, and its very illegal distilleries. This West Virginia background may also explain why Professor George plays with some skill an apparently musical instrument that I believe is called the banjo. Now, there are also the numerous public endeavors with which Professor George has been associated and which he's invested his time and energy. Most recently, he launched the American D.C.-based American Principles Project, which represents an attempt to reinvigorate, rearticulate, and reapply the principles of the American founding to America's contemporary problems. If ever there was such a need for such a return to the American founding, now is surely the time. That founding, of course, was based upon principles and ideas that purported not just to be American, but truly universal. And so it seems entirely appropriate, I think, that I ask Professor George, someone who is at once a philosopher, a lawyer, a theologian, a professor, a father, a husband, a seeker and defender of truth, and above all, a servant of Jesus Christ, to address us on the subject of natural law, God, and human rights. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sam, and thank you all for the invitation to be here to share with you this important experience that we're all having together here at Acton University. I want to begin by expressing my admiration for Father Sirico, for Sam Gregg, and for the work of the Acton Institute. And as someone who has benefited from many of the writings that have come from the Acton Institute. I want to say a special word of thanks to the board of directors and to those who have contributed their time and their effort and their money to the Acton Institute. It has been, let me assure you, a wonderful and productive investment. Ad multo annos, Father. Now, Sam has strictly enjoined me that I am to speak for 45 minutes and no more than that. So I'm going to take off my watch here and have it control me. You know, I've learned from my students that watches are now almost like dinosaurs. They're no longer needed. Everyone uses cell phones. The younger set uses cell phones, but I'm going to hang on to my watch. This watch has enormous sentimental value for me. Well, you may appreciate this as people who are interested in business and in cultivating a proper attitude toward business. This is the watch that my dear, departed, beloved grandfather, who was a wonderful businessman, on his deathbed sold to me. Keeping it close by. To sell it to my son. You know, Sam mentioned that I'm from West Virginia. I may be stepping across the line here, but I'll tell you the story that I was just told by my friend Rabbi David Novak. We were together for the meeting of the First Things Board of Editors just this past week, and Rabbi Novak, commenting on my being from West Virginia, told me this story. He said, yeah, West Virginia, Rabbi Novak is an American, but he lives in Canada at the moment. I doubt that he's ever been to West Virginia, but he said, he said, I know all about West Virginia. I heard a story about West Virginia once. And I said, what was that, Rabbi? And he said, well, it was a story about the West Virginian who went away to the Army. He was away, and he met a girl in some faraway place, and they fell in love, and so he brought her back to West Virginia to meet the family. And she had a wonderful visit, and everyone had a nice time together. And then when it was time for the girl to go back, off she went. And so the young man said to his mother and father, well, what do you think? I mean, she's a great girl, isn't she? Oh, yeah, she's a great girl. Well, we're thinking of being married. And at this, the parents get very resistant and say, no, 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 son. She ain't good enough for her own kinfolk. She ain't good enough for us. The things you hear from rabbis these days. Well, you've heard something, I'm sure, in your deliberations over the past few days about the concept of natural law that Sam was kind enough to say I've had a hand in trying to revive in our own, as Sam put it, very, very, very secular culture. But I think it's important for us to be clear about what a natural law theory is a theory of. There's a lot of misinformation. One is tempted to say a lot of disinformation floating around about out there about what this is all about. So let me reflect with you for a few minutes on what I think it's all about. And I'll try to be as simple and straightforward as possible. A natural law theory is, in essence, a critical reflective account of the constitutive aspects of the well-being and fulfillment of human persons and the communities they form. That's the core of it. That's what it comes down to in the end. So such a theory will propose to identify principles of right action, moral principles, specifying the first and most general principle of morality. If you've ever wondered what that is, the first and most general principle of morality, here's what I think it is. That one should choose and act in ways that are compatible with a will towards integral human fulfillment. Don't worry, I'll explain. Now, among these principles, if indeed they exist, are respect for the rights people possess simply by virtue of their humanity. In other words, rights that we have not because we've attained a certain age or status. Rights that we possess not because we're members of a particular clan or class or group or nationality, but rights that we possess simply by virtue of being members of the human family. Human rights, natural rights, rights which, as a matter of justice, others are bound to respect, and governments are bound not only to respect, but to the extent possible, to protect. the Declaration of Independence, in fact, goes so far as to tell us that it's for the protection of these rights that governments are instituted among men. That's probably a little bit of an overstatement, but there's a lot of truth in what the Declaration says on that point. And this account, I think, makes sense of that other great statement of the Declaration, that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men really are created equal. All of us as members of the human family are created equal, endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Rights that we have by virtue of our humanity, rights, therefore, that no human power created or conferred, and therefore that no merely human power may legitimately take away. So a human right is not like the right to a driver's license. The government gives, the government may take away. The government can restrict, the government can regulate. You've got to be 16 years old to have a driver's license. Now that I have kids, I wish it were 25 years old before you have a driver's license. But back when I was 16, I thought 16 was a pretty good age at which to have a driver's license. But the government could shift it to 25, and nobody's human rights would be violated. The right to a driver's license is unlike the right to life, or to religious liberty, or to economic freedom. Those are basic human rights. The government doesn't take them, the government can't take them away. They are natural rights, rights we have in virtue of our human nature. Now, natural law theorists of my particular ilk, that little band of fellow travelers Sam told you about, for us, as we understand natural law, the human good is variegated. There's not just one master human good. There are rather many irreducible aspects of human well-being, many different respects that are fundamental, reducible neither to something still more fundamental nor to each other, in which human beings can flourish, or if things go badly, decline. Many irreducible aspects of our well-being. And it's those aspects of our well-being taken together that constitute our integral well-being, integral human flourishing. That matter that is, if I'm right, the subject, the referent of the master principle of morality, choose and will in ways that are compatible with a will to integral human fulfillment. Now, in claiming as I do that there are many irreducible aspects of human well-being and fulfillment, I'm not denying that human nature is determinate. Of course human nature is determinate. Human beings are alike in some fundamental respects, no matter where you find them, across cultures and across the great span of history. So it's not to deny the determinateness of human nature, something that all natural law theorists affirm. It is rather to affirm that our nature, though determinate, is complex. We're animals, organisms, but rational. In fact, no one, I think, has yet improved on Aristotle's definition of man as a rational animal. Our integral good includes our bodily well-being, to be sure, because we are animals, but also our intellectual, moral, and spiritual well-being. We are very complicated animals. We can flourish or decline not only in respect of our physical health, but also in respect of our intellectual life, our moral life, our spiritual life. We can be enriched or impoverished in many distinct respects. A person may be flourishing as a physical organism, yet sunk into the mire morally or spiritually. And of course, it's possible for someone to be morally and spiritually very strong, but alas, suffering from grave physical debilitation. One thinks of John Paul the Great at the end of his life, still a spiritual giant, yet frail, debilitated. But because of his spiritual strength, able to use even his physical debilitation as witness to Christ. But there are other respects in which we are complicated, complex beings too. For example, we're individuals. That's the way we come packaged. But friendship and sociability are constitutive aspects of our flourishing. So though we're individuals, we are individuals who happen to be social by nature. Aristotle hit it right again. Man is a social being, a social animal. To use his language, a political animal, using political in a broader sense, one that I think we would translate more accurately today as social. Our flourishing, in addition to being in respect of health and morality and our spiritual well-being, also concerns our lives in communities, in relationships. No matter how intellectually adept and skillful we become, no matter how good we are when it comes to being in good physical shape, if we're friendless, if we're unable to form relationships that last and have meaning with people, we're impoverished. That's another respect in which we can flourish or decline. So, by reflecting on these diverse goods of human nature, all the respects in which human beings can flourish and do flourish when everything's going well for them, especially those most immediately pertaining to social and political life, natural law theorists propose to arrive at a sound understanding of principles of justice, including those principles we call human rights. So, the architecture as I see it is like this. There are moral principles, some subset of which are principles of justice. And there are principles of justice, some subset of which, very important subset of which, are principles we call human rights. Now, in light of what I've already said about how natural law theorists understand human nature and the human good, it should be no surprise to learn that natural law theorists typically reject both strict individualism and collectivism. Individualism in its radical and secularist form typically overlooks the intrinsic value of human sociability and tends mistakenly to view human beings atomistically. Critics of the philosophy of Ayn Rand, for example, or objectivism, make this claim against that school of thought. Collectivism, to take the other extreme, compromises the dignity of human beings by tending to instrumentalize and subordinate their well-being, the well-being of the person, the individual, to the interests of larger social units. So we see in its most extreme forms the great totalitarian systems of the 20th century, Nazism, communism, treating the person, the individual, not as the reason why we have economies and legal systems and political systems, the end to which everything else is a means, but rather treating persons as if they were means to larger ends, the ends of the state, the Volk, the fatherland, cogs in a larger wheel whose interests may be legitimately sacrificed, who may be killed, abused, exploited for the sake of some allegedly greater purpose. So radical individualists and collectivists both have theories of justice and human rights, but they are, as I see it, highly unsatisfactory. They're rooted in important misunderstandings of human nature and the human good. Neither, I think, in the end, and here's what it comes down to, neither the radical individualist theory nor the collectivist one can really do justice to the concept of a human person. That is, a rational animal who is a locus of intrinsic value and as such an end in himself who may never legitimately be reduced to a mere means, a cog in the wheel, but whose well-being intrinsically includes relationships with others and members in communities, beginning with the family in which he or she has, as a matter of basic justice, both rights and responsibilities. So when we act as individuals, it's intelligible, reasonable, many times desirable for us to act for the sake of our relationships with others. And when we act with others in common, we act not only jointly to achieve our individual goals, but for the sake of the relationships we form. think of the family. The family is not merely an instrumental relationship for its members, in the way that a business corporation can, for the most part, legitimately be an association for the interests of the individual members of the corporation. Family's different. Its common good is integral and intrinsic. Or the church, same way. We form the relationship of the church because of the intrinsic value of that relationship, the koinonia of the church. Right. Now, I'm sometimes asked whether we natural law theorists suppose that rights are hardwired into our nature. Well, I'm not sure I entirely understand what hardwiring is, but I fear that the metaphor is more likely to mislead than to illuminate. So let me tell you what I think is the case. Human rights exist if it is the case that there are principles of practical reason, moral principles, directing us to act or abstain from acting in certain ways out of respect for the well-being and dignity of persons whose legitimate interests may be affected by what we do. Now, I certainly believe that there are such principles. They cannot be overridden, as Jeremy Bentham would have us override them, by considerations of utility, the greater good, the greatest good for the greatest number. That neglects the dignity of the human person. At a very general level, they direct us, if I may borrow Immanuel Kant's famous phrase, to treat human beings always as ends and never as means only. That's pretty good. I've got a lot of problems with Kant's philosophy. Not on that score, though. That's right. To treat a human being as a person, which is exactly what we should do, all human beings, we treat them as ends and not merely as means that can be exploited, used up. This is what's wrong with slavery. This is what's wrong with abortion. Many of the greatest evils boil down simply to a violation of that principle. And by the way, since we're taking note of Kant's little summary phrase here, Kant says, treat humanity, whether in the person of yourself or another, always as an end and never as a means only. Kant's principle is not simply other regarding. It's not simply about how you should treat other people, though it is that. Kant rightly says that we must respect humanity in ourselves. We should avoid acts that degrade our own humanity. We should respect ourselves and avoid the kind of debauchery that would treat by which we would treat ourselves as a mere instrument of pleasure or satisfaction. Now, when we begin to specify this general norm about treating human beings as ends and never as means only, we identify important negative duties, such as the duty to refrain from enslaving people. Now, although we need not put the matter in terms of rights, and there are some Christians who object to the language of rights altogether. They think any talk about rights is inherently radically individualist, and it's un-Christian, and it's selfish, and so forth. Well, I don't agree with that, but if you do, we don't need to use the language of rights. We can translate all of the propositions of justice, the principles of justice that we try to capture with the concept of rights into other language. But I do believe it's helpful to speak in terms of rights. It's a good, supple language, as long as we're careful not to inflate rights claims or to imagine that all of morality comes down to rights, or that anything anybody claims to have a right to, in fact, they have a right to, or as long as we avoid the error of supposing that there can be rights without responsibility, and that it's all about rights and nothing about responsibility. Well, as long as we can avoid those errors, which I think we can, and the church, the modern church, certainly thinks we can, then it makes sense to speak of human rights, of natural rights, such as the right against being enslaved, and to speak of those as human rights. Take the right against slavery. It's a right that people have not by virtue of being members of a certain race or class or tribe, but merely in virtue of our humanity. That's the sense in which it's a human right. But there are, in addition to negative duties and their corresponding rights, positive duties. And often these too are articulated and discussed in the language of rights, but here I want to issue a warning to you. It's very important that if we're to speak of positive rights, we be clear in our own thinking and in the articulation of our arguments about by whom and how a given putative right is to be honored. Now, sometimes, and you're going to hear it more and more over the next weeks and months, sometimes it's said, for example, that education or health care is a right. All right. It's not unintelligible to speak that way. It's not out of bounds. But much more needs to be said if it's to be a meaningful statement that can genuinely be evaluated so that people can make up their minds whether they agree with it or not. Some questions have to be asked. Who is supposed to provide education or health care to whom? The mere assertion that there's a right to health care doesn't answer that question. And we have the right to demand an answer to that question. Who is supposed to provide health care to whom for that right to be honored? Why should those persons or those institutions be the providers? What place should the provision of education, however it's provided, or health care, however it's provided, occupy on the list of social and political priorities? Is it better for education and health care to be provided by governments under socialized systems or by private providers in markets? Simply to assert that there is a right to health care or that it's a bad thing that, you name your pick your number, 47 million Americans are without health insurance does not settle that critical question. And it shouldn't be allowed to mask that question so that people can evade answering it. Now, these questions go beyond the application of moral principles, and it's important to see that. They require prudential judgment in light of the contingent circumstances people face in a given society at a given point in time. And often there is not a uniquely correct answer, an answer that applies in all places and at all times. The answer to each question can lead to further questions, and the problems can be extremely complex, far more complex than the issue of slavery, where once a right has been identified, its universality and the basic terms of its application are fairly clear. Now, it might be hard to identify the right. For most of human history, most people couldn't see the right against slavery. But if you do see it, you see what it means and its application, the universality of its application, straightforwardly. That's not going to be the case when it comes to the assertion of positive rights. A whole set of questions has to be asked. Questions that cannot be answered simply by reference to moral principles. We need to know something about economics, something about psychology, something about sociology. And in light of all of those considerations, the ethical, yes, but also the economic, the sociological, the psychological, the contingent circumstances of our time, we need to exercise prudential judgment to ensure that we do not create a cure worse than the disease. And that's going to be true whether it's education or healthcare or what other positive right is being alleged. Now, what I've said so far, I hope, will provide a pretty good idea of how I think we ought to go about identifying what are human rights. But in each case, the argument must be made, and in many cases, there are great complexities to the argument, and that's true when it comes to negative as well as positive rights. Now, one basic human right that almost all natural law theorists would say belongs in the set of human rights, is the right of an innocent person not to be directly killed or maimed. The Catholics in the group will recall the very formal articulation of this principle and of this right in the letter, Pope John Paul's letter Evangelium Vitae, encyclical Evangelium Vitae, where he stated again in the most solemn possible terms that the direct killing of an innocent human being is always what he called grave matter. We could sum up being wrong. That is, if you know about it, if you know what it is you're doing, it's wrong. Now, this is a right that's violated when someone makes the death or injury of another person the precise object of his action. It's the right that grounds the norm against targeting non-combatants, even in justified wars, and against abortion, euthanasia, and other death-dealing acts against innocent human beings. Now, of course, as we all know, in the case of abortion, some people argue that human beings in the embryonic or fetal stages of development do not yet qualify as persons and so do not yet possess human rights. But in the case of euthanasia, some argue that permanently comatose or severely retarded or demented people do not or no longer qualify as rights bearers. Well, I think that these arguments are gravely, grievously mistaken. But I won't here go into my reasons for holding that the moral status of a human being does not depend on his or her age or size or stage of development or condition of dependency. If anybody's interested in my views about that, you might have a look at a book that I published last year with my friend Chris Tollefson called Embryo, A Defense of Human Life, where Professor Tollefson and I go into great detail in defending the proposition that all human beings, irrespective of age or size or stage of development or condition of dependency, have profound, inherent, and equal dignity. And we offer systematic criticisms of the writings of people like Peter Singer and Ronald Dworkin and others who want to claim that not all human beings are persons, not all human beings bear rights. There are pre-personal human beings and post-personal human beings, and human beings like the severely retarded who were never persons, aren't now persons, and never will be persons. For now, for here, for our purposes this evening, I only want to say that anyone who happens not to share my conviction that human beings in the early stages of development or in severely debilitated conditions are rights bearers may nevertheless agree that whoever qualifies as a person is protected by the norm against directly killing the innocent. Now, the natural law understanding of human rights I'm here sketching is connected with a particular account of human dignity, and let me sketch this for you. Under that account, the natural human capacities for reason and freedom are fundamental to the dignity of human beings, the dignity that is protected by human rights. The basic goods of human nature, all those fundamental aspects of our well-being and fulfillment as human beings, are the goods of a rational creature, a creature who, unless impaired or prevented from doing so, naturally develops and exercises capacities for deliberation, judgment, and choice. Rational capacities. Now, these capacities, I want to put it to you, are God-like, literally God-like, albeit, of course, in a limited way. We're not God. But, in fact, from the theological vantage point, these capacities constitute a certain sharing, limited to be sure, but real, in divine power. Aquinas, in a famous question, says, and I think there's a profound truth in this, that while God leads the brute animals to the ends he desires for them by instinct, by instilling in them instinct, you know, the lion does what he does to the zebra so that he can survive by instinct, man, unlike the brute animals, yes, we're animals, but unlike the brute animals, man is a rational animal. God has chosen to lead to his proper end, not only by instinct, but also by the reason that God has planted in him, the logos that he shared, that God shares with the human being as a kind of gift, a sharing in this divine power. This is what is meant, I believe, by the otherwise absolutely inexplicable biblical teaching that man is made in the very image and likeness of God. I mean, what could it mean? I mean, it can't mean that that God has five fingers on each of two hands or has a nose or hair. So what does it mean? Well, it seems to me that what it means is we are made, we're godlike, in that like God, we possess reason and freedom. But whether or not one recognizes biblical authority or even believes in a personal God, it's true and it's evident that human beings possess a power traditionally ascribed to divinity, namely the power to cause things that one is not caused to cause, the power of freedom, rationality. This is the power to envisage a possible state of affairs that does not exist, to grasp the value of bringing that state of affairs into being by one's actions, and then acting by choice in light of one's reasons for acting, and not merely on impulse or instinct to bring that state of affairs into being. Now, that state of affairs may be anything from the development of an intellectual skill or the attainment of greater knowledge, what we're all here this evening and at this university trying to do, to the creation of a critical appreciation of a work of art, to the establishment of marital communion. the moral and cultural significance of what one brings about in the exercise of one's godlike powers of reason and freedom may be of great significance or, more often, not something especially earth-shattering. What matters for the point I'm here making is that it is a product of human reason and freedom. We're not operating like ants or lions or even dolphins or chimpanzees. We're acting, rather, as rational creatures, sharing that little bit of godlike power. Now, again, this is not to suggest that we are God. Obviously, we're not. We're limited. We're finite. We're sinful. But God has chosen to share with us the Logos, this rationality, this freedom. We are in a bit, please don't misunderstand me, but we are in a very limited sense uncaused causings, the way traditionally God is conceived. Now, again, it's a limited sense. We're not uncaused in the sense that no one caused us to exist. God caused us to exist, but no one caused God to exist. But like God, we are capable of causing things that we are not caused to cause. We can choose to cause them or choose not to cause them. We can understand the point of causing them, bringing them about, bringing them into being, and act on the basis of that point, or we can be deflected from action and choose not to act for good or for ill. That freedom is genuinely unique to the human species. Even those animals who are sometimes credited with having language or a certain sense of rationality don't do that. Their nature is not a rational nature in the way that human nature is a rational nature. And again, you don't have to be a Christian to understand that, although I hope all Christians do. Aristotle got hold of it. Plato understood it. It was at the heart of the thinking of many of the Roman jurists in the pre-Christian period. People had no access to the Christian or Jewish revelation, but they understood something profoundly important about the nature of man as a rational nature. Now, we may, if we like, consider as a further matter whether beings capable of exercising these literally godlike powers could exist apart from a divine source and ground of their being. But I don't think it makes sense to deny that beings whose nature is to develop and exercise these powers of reason and freedom are lacking in dignity and human rights and may therefore be treated as mere objects, instruments, or property. Why do we distinguish an ox from a human being? Why do we reject slavery, or should reject slavery, for humans but not for oxes? Why do we have a special dignity, and what does it consist? It's that rational nature, that those godlike capacities. Now, they may be blocked in any particular individual. I mean, a severely retarded person has those capacities blocked. He can't realize. I mean, everything is straining toward it, as parents of severely retarded children know about their children. Everything is straining toward it, but something's blocking it. But that doesn't mean that that child is an ox or just like an ox, because that child, too, has a rational nature. He's organized for rationality. Test it. Test it with a thought experiment. If suddenly they came up with a cure for the problem, say some genetic intervention or something like that, and the child were all of a sudden freed from the burden of that retardation, would you be turning him from one kind of being into another kind of being? Would you be changing his nature? No. You'd be perfecting him in the nature he has. But if you suddenly made an ox walk and talk and ask for the car keys, you would be changing him from one kind of thing into another. So that's our dignity, our unique dignity as human beings. Now, what about the authority for this view of human nature, the human good, human dignity, and human rights? Well, natural law theorists are interested in the intelligible reasons people have for their choices and actions. We're particularly interested in reasons that can be identified without appeal to any authority apart from the authority of reason itself. Now, this is not to deny that it is often reasonable to recognize and submit to authority of various types, religious authority included, certainly, legal authority. Indeed, natural law theorists have made important contributions to understanding why and how people can sometimes be morally bound to submit to and be guided in their actions by authority of various types, including the authority of the church, the authority of the scripture. But even here, the special concern of natural law theorists is with the reasons people have for recognizing and honoring claims to authority. We don't simply appeal to authority to justify authority. So you have to understand the natural law position when it comes to questions of authority, not as some kind of an anarchic position or a position that says we should never submit to authority. We should always be guided simply by the light of our own reason in everything. No, because we understand that sometimes there are conclusive reasons for honoring the claims of authority, whether it be religious or secular. But we're interested in the reasons for it. We don't simply appeal to authority as the justification for authority. And again, some of the greatest contributions to the theory of authority, to understanding why we should sometimes submit to authority, have been made by Christian writers, whether Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century or Elizabeth Anscombe or John Finnis in the 20th and 21st. Well, one might ask then whether human beings are in fact rational, as I'm claiming they are. Do we in fact have these powers that I'm making the linchpin of human dignity and the foundation of natural law? Can we discern any intelligible reasons for human choices and actions? Well, everybody recognizes that some ends or purposes pursued through human action are intelligible, at least insofar as they provide means to other ends. For example, people work to earn money, and their doing so is perfectly rational. Money is a valuable means to a great many important ends. No one doubts the instrumental value of money. Now, no one really thinks that money is intrinsically valuable. That's the other side of this equation. I mean, if you couldn't do something with it, you don't want money just for its own sake. I mean, you might want it for to buy things, you might want it for the prestige that attaches to it, or the power, or the security, but you want it for something else. So even skeptics do not deny that there are instrumental goods. Money's just one example. The question is whether some ends or purposes are intelligible as providing more than merely instrumental reasons for acting. If there are, then there really are intelligible aspects of human well-being and fulfillment, whose integral directiveness is the core of our moral obligations. So are there intrinsic and not merely instrumental human goods? Skeptics deny that there are intelligible ends or purposes that make possible rationally motivated action. Natural law theorists, by contrast, hold that friendship, knowledge of the sort we're pursuing here together, virtue, aesthetic appreciation, and certain other ends or purposes are intrinsically and not merely instrumentally valuable. Just take friendship as an easy example. If someone wanted to be a friend only for instrumental purposes, you wouldn't be much of a friend. You wouldn't, whatever that would be, that wouldn't be a friendship. That might be some alliance or association or pact. It wouldn't be a friendship. Part of what makes friendship a friendship is that it's not instrumentalized to the ends of either friend. Just take the simple model of two friends. That relationship itself is something valued by the two friends for its own sake. The friend doesn't want to be the friend of the other friend simply because the other friend's cool, his father's important and might be able to get you a good job, he's in with the right crowd and you might be able to get theater tickets, you know, whatever. If that's your attitude toward your friend, whatever that relationship is, it's not a friendship. It's a friendship. You're valuing the relationship itself intrinsically and not merely instrumentally. Right? So these ends or purposes that are intrinsically valuable and not merely reducible to their instrumental value are things that are ends in themselves. They can't be reduced to, nor can their intelligible appeal be accounted for exclusively in terms of emotion, feeling, desire, or other subrational motivating factors. These basic human goods are then constitutive aspects of the well-being and fulfillment of human persons and the communities they form, and they thereby provide the foundations of moral judgments, including judgments pertaining to justice and human rights. It's the norms of conduct, such as the golden rule to do unto others as you would have them do unto you, the Pauline principle that one must never do evil, even for the sake of good consequences, the specific norms against direct killing of the innocent, for example, or other matters that are prohibited, say, under the Ten Commandments. These norms are entailments of, they follow from, the integral directiveness of the range of human goods that are the content of our fulfillment, our flourishing as human beings. Someone who truly wills the human good and wills it integrally will be fair, will honor the golden rule, will respect the Pauline principle, will not reduce others to mere objects, killing them for medical benefits or to get ahead or exploiting them by slavery or other bad actions. Now, of course, there are plenty of people today who embrace philosophical or ideological doctrines that deny the human capacities that I maintain are at the core of human dignity. They adopt a purely instrumental and essentially non-cognitivist view of practical reason. It was most famously formulated in the 18th century by the father of modern skepticism, the Scottish-turned-English philosopher David Hume, who famously said, and this captures it perfectly, here's where the divide is. Here's what divides the natural law camp from the skeptical camp. Hume laid it out. His position was that reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions and may pretend to no office other than to serve and obey them. There's the skeptical position. If you believe that, you're a skeptic. If you deny that, you're quite likely in the natural law camp. So for skeptics like Hume and those many, many, many philosophers today who are his modern followers, the human experience of deliberation, judgment, and choice really is illusory. The ends people pursue, these philosophers would argue, are ultimately given by non-rational motivating factors, such as feeling, emotion, and desire. Sure, people think they're operating for reasons. They think they're choosing for reasons that are not merely reducible to the satisfaction of desire or for feeling or emotion, but that's an illusion. People think they're acting freely, exercising free will, but the reality is there's no such thing as free will. All our actions are determined, either by external forces acting on us or by the internal compulsion of feeling, emotion, these sub-rational motivating factors that Hume summed up as the passions. Reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions. Reason's role is purely instrumental. It can't tell you what to want. Can only tell you how to get what you happen to want. Your wants being given by subrational motivating factors like feeling and emotion, the passions. So, if there are no more than merely instrumental reasons, no basic human goods, if Hume and the skeptics are right, then it seems to me that the entire business of ethics is a charade and human dignity is a myth. If they're right, here's what you'd have to say, something like this. Well, Hitler, for whatever subrational motivating reasons, not reasons really, but subrational on whatever subrational motivations, wanted to kill a lot of Jews. Mother Teresa wanted to save a lot of people on the streets of Calcutta. Reason can't tell you which of those is better or superior, can't judge between them. All reason could do, either for Hitler or Mother Teresa, was to find the way to achieve their goals being given by the subrational motivating factors like feeling and desire. So Hitler could use reason to figure out how to get more Jews into gas chambers. Mother Teresa could use reason to figure out how to save more people and comfort more dying people on the streets of Calcutta. So on that count, you know, there's just no such thing as human dignity, and at the end of the day, there's no such thing as ethics. But needless to say, I don't think that these Humeans, these skeptics, are right. Indeed, I don't think they can give any account of the norms of rationality to which they must themselves appeal in making the case against reason and freedom, making the case that our experience of deliberation, judgment, and choice is a mere illusion that is consistent with the denial that people are capable of more than merely instrumental rationality and true freedom of choice. I won't go into more detail about it here. It gets deeply into the weeds. But for anybody who's interested, you might have a look at a debate that I have had with a very capable Australian philosopher who defends Hume's position named Geoffrey Goldsworthy. It took place, it was originally published in the pages of the American Journal of Jurisprudence. It's easy to find. And in that debate, what essentially it comes down to is this question of whether someone defending the Humean position can, in the end, logically and consistently defend it while asserting the position itself. My view is that any effort to defend that position will appeal, if only implicitly, but really, to the intelligible value of the knowledge of the truth that's being asserted as a truth by the person who's asserting the skeptical position. So I think that the argument fails by retorsion. It's a self-defeating proposition. Well, in any event, however that may turn out, please notice that the argument being made by the natural law theorists is not that emotion never figures in our actions. On the contrary, emotion figures in all of our actions. The question is whether sometimes, at least, reason also figures in our actions in a more than merely instrumental way, and sometimes is decisive, as, for example, we want what we want because we see the intelligible point, the benefit for us, for those with whom we're in relationships, for people we care about, for people in general. We see the benefit, the intelligible point of performing the action. We see the human good, the aspect of human flourishing that can be advanced by performing the action. Now, if I and other natural law theorists are correct in affirming that human reason can identify human rights as genuine grounds of obligation to others, how can we explain or understand widespread failures to recognize and respect human rights and other moral principles? One thing we know is that there's an awful lot of evil in the world. How can that be? Well, as human beings, we're rational animals, but, of course, we are imperfectly rational. We're prone to making intellectual and moral mistakes, and we're capable, alas, of behaving grossly unreasonably, especially when we're deflected by powerful emotions that run contrary to the demands of reasonableness, or when, culpably or not, we operate under religious or ideological influences that lead us to stray from reason's path. If we look at the history of exploitation, the history of abuse, the history of evils, we find that very often people are misled into believing the most horrible things and accepting the most horrible things because the ideologies that are dominant in the society are just taken on board, just assumed to be true. And people go along, even with horrendous evils. A conscientious judgment, even a conscientious judgment, by a person who wants to do good, may be erroneous. Yes, we're bound to follow our conscience. That's one of the moral rules. But our conscience can fail. It's not just people of bad will who make moral mistakes. All of us do, including people of goodwill. Some of the greatest thinkers who ever lived failed to recognize, for example, a right that I know Father Sirico cares a lot about and has done a lot to advance here and around the world, the right to religious liberty. Great men, some of my intellectual heroes, have failed to grasp that right, have even denied it. Now, their failure, I believe, was rooted in a set of intellectual and religious errors about what such a right, this right to religious liberty, presupposes and entails. But the people who made these errors, again, were not knaves or fools. The errors were not obvious, and it was only with a great deal of reflection and debate that the matter was clarified. Now, of course, sometimes people fail to recognize and respect human rights because they have self-interested motives for doing so. That's common enough. In most cases of exploitation, for example, the fundamental failing is moral, not intellectual. People exploit people usually not because they're making intellectual mistakes, but because they're trying to get something out of them and get ahead. It's self-interest that's driving that train, illegitimate self-interest. In some cases, though, intellectual and moral failures are closely connected. Selfishness, prejudice, partisanship, vanity, avarice, lust, ill will and other moral delinquencies can, in ways that are sometimes quite subtle, and all of us know this from our own experience, just how subtle it can be, impede sound ethical judgments, including judgments pertaining to human rights. Whole cultures or subcultures can be infected with moral failings that blind large numbers of people to truths about justice and human rights. And ideologies hostile to these truths will almost always be both causes and effects of these failings. Now, I know, you know, in the age of multiculturalism, you're not supposed to say things like I just said. But it's true, and it's unavoidable, and it's inescapable. Consider, for example, the case of slavery in the antebellum American South. The ideology of white supremacy was both a cause of many people's blindness to the wickedness of slavery and an effect of the exploitation and degradation of its victims. And we should all be sobered, all of us, black or white, we should all be sobered by the recognition that in circumstances in which ideology is hostile to a sound understanding of natural law, of the dignity of the human being, of human rights, that in an environment like that, good people can go badly astray. Think of Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederacy. Of course, someone who deeply believed in slavery. But someone who was also, in many ways, profoundly honorable, wouldn't tell a lie, wouldn't cheat. The kind of guy who, if he was in a shop and he paid for his item and he was given back $2 extra in change, would return the $2. He wasn't a moral monster. He wasn't Hitler. How did a good man like that go astray into believing something as horrific as the proposition that people can own and sell and buy and use up their fellow human beings? It should sober us all. It should make us think really carefully, really critically, to ensure that we avoid being swept up in fashions and trends or ideologies that genuinely are hostile to the dignity of human beings. Now let me turn to the question of God and religious faith in natural law theory. Very, very important question, I think widely misunderstood. Now it's certainly true that most, but not all, natural law theorists are theists. That's been true historically, and it's certainly true today. They believe, we believe, that the moral order, like every other order in human experience, the logical order, the order of nature, the order of technique, or techne, whatever it's all called, techne, is what it is because God creates and sustains it as such. In accounting for the intelligibility of the created order, we infer the existence of a free and creative intelligence, a logos, a personal God. Indeed, we typically argue that God's creative free choice provides the most intellectually satisfactory account of the existence of the intelligibilities humans grasp in every domain of inquiry. Now, of course, people who arrive at the belief in God, some of whom arrive at that belief for intellectual reasons, will also have that belief reinforced and affirmed by the personal relationship that they are able to develop with God, with Christ. But most natural law theorists do believe that if you ask the question, what accounts for the intelligibilities in the moral order and every other order in which we live, most natural law theorists are going to say a creative, benevolent, loving, all-powerful God. Now, those natural law theorists certainly do not deny that God can reveal moral truths. And most of us believe that God has chosen to reveal a great many such truths, beginning with the commandments of the Decalogue. However, natural law theorists also affirm that many moral truths, including some that are revealed, can also be grasped by ethical reflection, even apart from revelation. We assert, with St. Paul in the letter to the Romans, that there is a law written on the hearts even of the Gentiles who do not have the law of Moses, a law the knowledge of which is sufficient for moral accountability, as Paul teaches. So the basic norms against murder and theft, for example, though revealed in the Ten Commandments, are knowable even apart from God's special revelation, and people can be held responsible for violating them, even if they have no access to divine revelation. The natural law can be known by us, and we can conform our conduct to its terms by virtue of our natural human capacities for deliberation, judgment, and choice, those very capacities that are at the ground of our dignity, if I'm right. Now, the absence of a divine source of the natural law would be a puzzling thing, just as the absence of a divine source of any and every other intelligible order in human experience would be a puzzling thing. We'd have to wonder how that happened. An atheist's puzzlement might well cause him to reconsider the idea that there is no divine source of the order we perceive and understand in the universe. And such a reconsideration figures in the accounts given by some eminent modern philosophers of their religious conversions. You can start the list with some of the most important Anglophone, English-speaking philosophers. Elizabeth Anscombe, in accounting for her conversion, talked about precisely that reconsideration. Michael Dummett, Alasdair MacIntyre, Peter Geech, Nicholas Rescher, John Finnis, who taught Sam and me, Bastian von Frassen, my colleague at Princeton. It's far less, I think, likely to cause someone to conclude that our perception is illusory or that our understanding is a sham, though that is certainly logically possible. The question then arises,
Can natural law, assuming that there are true principles of natural law, provide a basis for common understanding, even across denominations of religion, across cultures, without a consensus on the existence and nature of God and the role of God in human affairs? Well, in my view, anybody who acknowledges the human capacities for reason and freedom and sees that they are fundamental and quite literally godlike has good grounds for affirming human dignity and basic human rights. They can at least get in the game of ethics. We can argue about the details, but that gives us a foundation for arguing and terms of dialogue, terms of discussion. These grounds remain in place whether or not one chooses then to advert to that very important question: is there a divine source of the moral order whose tenets we discern in inquiry regarding natural law and natural rights? Now, I happen to think the answer to that question is yes, there is a divine source. There must be a divine source. And that we should be open to the possibility that God, who provides that divine source, has disclosed himself in ways that reinforce and supplement what can be known by unaided reasons. Those philosopher converts I mentioned a few minutes ago are all people who tell the story of their conversions as kind of being led intellectually to the rejection of secularism or atheism, to the affirmation that there must be a divine source and ground of our being, but then, of course, enter into the Christian community, enter into an ever-deepening relationship with God. They're not stuck at the affirmation that there is a divine source of the realities that we experience. They then are interested in what God has disclosed about himself and God's willingness to enter into a deeper and deeper friendship with us, to share more fully with us his divine life. But having said that, we don't need agreement even on the God question so long as we agree about the truths that give rise to the question, namely that human beings possessing the godlike, literally awesome, powers of reason and freedom are bearers of a profound dignity that is protected by certain basic rights. Even in primitive cultures, where the idea of ethical monotheism has not yet emerged or taken hold, where there's a perception of the divine is perceived as that which has an ability to cause things freely. So that when we affirm that reality in ourselves as human beings, we're talking about something like what the Quakers have in mind when they talk about a divine spark, a godlike quality, something that literally inspires awe in the way that primitive people have awe inspired in them by contemplating that which, as they perceive it, is an uncaused causing. So if there's a set of moral norms, including norms of justice and human rights, that can be known by rational inquiry, understanding, and judgment, even apart from any special revelation, then these norms of natural law can indeed provide the basis for a shared understanding of human rights, at least the basis of a conversation across cultures, across religions, about certain core issues of human rights, like the right to life, like religious freedom, like the treatment of women and others with respect so that we're not subjecting them to abuse or allowing them to be severely mistreated. Now, of course, we should not expect consensus, not in this veil of tears. There are moral skeptics who deny that there are any moral truths, plenty of those certainly where I live. There are religious fideists who hold that moral truths cannot be known apart from God's revelation, so they're not interested in entering into the conversation with anybody who's not a member of their particular tradition. And even among those who believe in natural law, there will be differences of opinion about its precise content and implications for certain issues. That's what some of our great moral debates are about. So it is, I believe, our permanent condition to discuss and debate these issues, both as a matter of abstract philosophy and as a matter of practical politics. I don't envisage some 5-year plan or 10-year plan or 10 billion year plan by which we solve all the moral problems and don't have to have moral conversations anymore. There's a certain truth in the idea that the great moral questions are perennial questions. Now, it's sometimes regarded as an embarrassment to natural law thinking that some great ancient and medieval figures in the natural law tradition failed to recognize and have even denied human rights that are affirmed by contemporary natural law theorists and even regarded as fundamental. Consider, for example, the basic human right to religious liberty, what the Constitution of the United States refers to as the right to the free exercise of religion. This right was not widely acknowledged in the past and was even denied by some prominent natural law theorists. They wrongly believed that a wide conception of liberty in matters of faith presupposed religious relativism or indifferentism, or entailed that religious vows are not binding or are immoral, or the comprehensive subservience of ecclesial communities to the state. In other words, they assumed that what religious liberty meant was what the French revolutionaries meant by it. Now, it's interesting that when the Catholic Church, and it was late, it's in the 1960s at the Second Vatican Council, put itself on record firmly in support of the robust conception of the right to religious liberty, going beyond just the proposition that faith can't be coerced, which has always been the doctrine of the Catholic Church, although not always respected by those who call themselves Catholics, but going beyond that to acknowledge what the Baptists got to before the Catholics did, the idea that robust religious freedom really meant not merely the right to believe as one was led by his best lights to believe, but also to propagate his beliefs, to defend his beliefs in the public square, to witness to others as to those beliefs. Well, when the Catholic Church put itself on record, it presented in the document Dignitatis Humanae of the Second Vatican Council both a natural law argument and an argument from specifically theological sources. Those of you who've read the document, and I know this one has been read by many non-Catholics as well as Catholics, will recognize that in the first half of the document, the fathers of the council set out a pure natural law argument. No appeal to revelation, no appeal to specifically religious sources or the authority of the church. And in the second half, of course, the specifically theological argument is presented, but they're regarded as complementary. The natural law argument for religious liberty is founded on the obligation of each person to pursue the truth about religious matters and to live in conformity with his conscientious judgments. So the church entirely rightly, in my view, but who am I to be judging whether the church is right or not, but entirely rightly in my view, what the church is doing here is not just asserting blindly or baldly there's a right to religious freedom. It's showing where the right comes from. The right is itself an implication of an obligation that's still more fundamental. What's that obligation? The obligation of each of us to consider the religious question, to consider the greatest issue that any human being can contemplate. What is there a God? What has God disclosed? What does God require of me? How can I bring myself into richer and fuller communion with my Maker? The obligation of each person to pursue the truth in religious matters and live in conformity with his best judgments. This obligation is in turn rooted in the proposition that religion, considered as conscientious truth-seeking regarding the ultimate sources of meaning and value, is a crucial dimension of human well-being and fulfillment. It's one of those aspects of human well-being in which we can flourish or decline, something that provides one of the most fundamental aspects of our flourishing. We can flourish or fail to flourish in our spiritual lives, just as we can flourish or fail to flourish in our moral and intellectual lives, and even in our physical well-being. So it's among those basic human goods that provide rational motivation for our choosing. The right to religious liberty follows from the dignity of man as a truth seeker. Well, let me wrap up. This right and other human rights are denied and attacked today from various quarters, as you know. And in many parts of the world, of course, they're routinely violated. We live in an age of rights inflation. Everybody's claiming rights to everything. But we also see rights just routinely violated across the globe. The ideological justification for their denial and violation can be religious or secular. In some parts of the world, religious freedom and other basic human rights are denied in the name of theological truth. Guess what's going on in Iran right now? The justification of tyranny by appeal to theology, a theocratic government trying to preserve its own power by asserting divine authority. In other parts of the world, the threats are from secularist ideologies. Where secularist ideologies are liberal in form, as they are for the most part in the United States, dominant in places like the place I live, it's often claims to an overarching right to autonomy that are asserted to justify choices and actions and policies that natural law theorists believe are unjust and undermine the human good. The attack on innocent human life and abortion and embryo destructive research. The attack on marriage as the conjugal union of husband and wife. All asserted in the name of this overarching right to autonomy. If the natural law view of these matters is correct, then it is moral failings conspiring with intellectual errors that sustain ideologies that compromise human rights and the common good. In a certain sense, the failings are at opposite poles. Yet from a natural law vantage point, partisans of the competing ideologies make some valid criticisms of each other. Radical Islamists, for example, harshly condemn the decadent features of cultures in which an ideology of expressive and or possessive individualism flourishes. I was told by Archbishop Akinola, the Anglican Archbishop of one of the African countries, to help me, Nigeria. I had the honor of having dinner with him. And, of course, his flock is under severe pressure from some pretty radical Islamic forces. But even apart from the actual physical military attacks, he says that we in the West have made it very, very hard for him to defend the Christian faith, this Anglican Archbishop, against the pressure of Islam upon his people by our own decadence. He says that the Islamic, equivalent of missionaries, will make the point apologetically that Christianity must be a false religion because if you look in the Christian countries, men can marry men. There's a price to be paid for these ideologies, even when it comes to something like what Archbishop Akinola faces in his country. On the other side, expressive individualists denounce the subjugation of women and the oppression of religious dissenters where fundamentalist Islam holds sway. And they're certainly right to do that as well. I mean, the treatment of women in certain Islamic countries, not all certainly, but in some really is horrendous and appalling. As natural law theorists see it, threats to human dignity and human rights exist because all of us as human beings are imperfectly reasonable and imperfectly moral. Those of us who are Christians have a doctrine about this called original sin. We can go off the rails. We can mess up. At the same time, hope exists because we really do. Despite all our flaws, despite being the mere dust of the earth, despite being sinners, we really do possess the capacities for reasonableness and virtue. And God, for whatever reason, seems willing to help us, if we're willing to accept his help, to live reasonable and virtuous lives. Truth, including moral truth, is accessible to us and has its own splendor and powerful appeal. The lion has no choice as to whether to take down the zebra. He can't morally deliberate about whether that's right or wrong. We human beings can. We can decide. We can decide in light of our best understanding of human dignity and human flourishing whether we're going to do this or that. Now, of course, we will never, in this veil of tears, grasp the truth completely or in a way that is entirely free from errors. Original sin is with us for the long haul, the theologians tell me. Nor will we fully live up to the moral truths, even to those moral truths that we grasp. St. Paul has a very good teaching about that as well. Often enough, we know what the right thing to do is. The failure is not one of knowledge. But just as we made progress by abolishing the evil of slavery, by ending legally sanctioned racial segregation, by turning away from the early 20th century doctrine of eugenics, though alas, we seem to be returning to that one, and by recognizing, after many, many years, and in some cases centuries, the right to religious freedom, natural law theorists hope that we can make progress and reverse declines in other areas. Of course, people who reject the natural law understanding of human dignity and human rights will differ from natural law theorists on questions of what constitutes progress and decline. From an Islamist point of view, the type of religious freedom defended by natural law theorists will be regarded as licensing heresy and religious irresponsibility. Those guys aren't interested in talk of a right to religious freedom. Natural law ideas will be seen as merely a rhetorically toned-down form of secularist rationalism and possessive individualism. By contrast, from the point of view of secularist rationalist intellectuals, like many of my colleagues, natural law ideas about abortion, sexuality, and other hot-button moral issues will be regarded as intolerant and oppressive. You've all heard that argument. A philosophically gussied-up form of religious fundamentalism. Now, that's a slander, but it's a slander that's very widely believed in elite intellectual circles and in places inhabited by the beautiful people like in Hollywood. These are people who think that the answer to an argument is to call your opponent a bigot. In the end, though, natural law ideas, like Islamist or liberal secularist ideas, will have to stand or fall on their merits. We need to be prepared, in season and out of season, always and everywhere, to make the argument, to provide the reasons for respecting the integrity and the dignity of human life, for honoring marriage as the conjugal union of husband and wife, for the greatness of the market economy as an institution that has freed more people from poverty, as Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks said to me the other day when he visited Princeton, has freed more people from poverty than any anti-poverty program anybody's ever created, has created the opportunity for social mobility for people like myself, whose grandfathers were coal miners. We need to be prepared always and everywhere to give a reason, to make a defense, to make an argument. They may respond by calling us bigots. They may respond by calling us heretics, depending on whether it's coming from one school of thought or the other. But we mustn't be deflected or intimidated by any of that. Our task is patiently, winsomely, but firmly and strongly to make the argument in season and out of season. The argument's there to be made. It's a powerful argument in every case, a good argument. Up to us to make it. Thanks so much.